The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra Election Day Special. The group stages of the Champions League are done. Liverpool and Chelsea join Spurs and Manchester City in the knockout stages, along with, well, all the other big teams and Atalanta. We'll decide if that's a good thing or not, tell you the permutations and have a guess at who might win it. There's some Football League to round up, there's some fun January transfer window gossip, and might the offside armpit cease to be an offside armpit? We'll look ahead to the weekend's Premier League games and give Philippe a minute to try and talk about FIFA without us all getting sued. All that, plus your questions on today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, I gave it away, Philippe Auclair. Hello.
Good morning to you, Max.
Nicky Bandini, nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Hey, Jonathan Wilson.
Morning.
Before the pod started, the discussion was about things you weren't allowed to watch as a child. We'll save it for the end, but...
Okay, I mean, I, to be totally fair to my parents, yeah. It was more actively discouraged than banned.
Right, I see.
Which is more insidious in many ways.
Well, we'll find out what they were. But let's start with a couple of tweets which were sent last night. The first one reads, as it stands, for the first time ever, only teams from England, Spain, Germany, Italy and France in the last 16 of the Champions League. Hurrah for the rich lads. That was followed up with, this is, it goes without saying, a terrible day for sport, a triumph for those who manipulated the competition to make the rich even richer and let the rest of the world function as nothing more than a vast farm supplying raw material for their product machines. Jonathan, you wrote those.
Yeah, I did. Do you want me to just do this in future? Just write what I'm going to say in advance so you can read it out.
I mean, there's no need for a panel. All I'll do is it will be Jonathan Wilson's soliloquies as read by me. Explain yourself. Were you being facetious there, or you think this is a real devastating...
No, it's an appalling thing for the world.
Because?
Because we've seen, like, over the last 40 years, if you look across the Western world, look at incomes, the incomes of the very rich have got greater, and the incomes of the poor have got less, and the inequality has grown. And that is the economic system we're in. That is neoliberalism, that is globalization. And this in football is emblematic of that. It's a result of that. This is what untrammeled capitalism gets you to, particularly when you let those big clubs create a system which perpetuates their wealth. So in 1987-8, the champions of Italy, Napoli, drew the champions of Spain, Real Madrid, in the first round of the old European Cup. And this horrified all the big clubs. So why are we doing this? Why are we letting ourselves be knocked out in the first round? And that's what leads to the talks which lead to the Champions League. And then as you admit more teams from each country, you can argue the quality of the competition goes up. I think you certainly can argue that the football we've seen in the knockout stages of the Champions League over the last two or three seasons has been the best football ever played. But the cost of that is that even leagues that were quite major, so the Dutch and the Portuguese leagues, between them have 10 European Cups / Champions Leagues, they're fringe players now. Ajax getting to the semi-final last year was sort of miraculous. Now, I appreciate within that Atalanta are an exception. You know, they are a smaller team. They are a bit of a fairy story. And I certainly don't think that the economic situation of football would be better this morning if oligarch-owned Shakhtar Donetsk had beaten them last night. But still, the overwhelming trend is towards the rich getting richer and the rest of the world just becoming this... this farm that kind of just feeds all this raw material into Western Europe. David Goldblatt's new book, The Age of Football, is very, very good on this. So to give you one example of how insidious this is, in Ghana, for instance, the big derbies between Ashanti Kotoko and Hearts of Oak 20 years ago would get 60, 70, 80,000 fans. They now get 20 or 30,000. Because if you're a fan in Ghana and you want to watch the best football or the best Ghanaian players, you go to the bar and you watch it on telly. You don't go to the stadium. And that's happening all over the world. So we've taken football from the world and we've brought it here to Western Europe. And our clubs are benefiting. And it's great for us because we get to watch it in the stadiums every week. But it's appalling for the rest of the world.
I basically agree with Jonathan. I think that the sort of central
point there, which to me isn't necessarily a new point. I understand why you highlight it now because of what's happened this year.
This has been coming.
But this has been coming for, for a long time.
There was two non-Big Five teams in the last 16 last year. I think it was four the year before, two the year before that. If you look at the 5 years before that, there was an average of five. So this is a trend, but we've reached the end point of that trend.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in many ways it's been Serie A teams underperforming that has prevented us from getting to this point before. I think what's interesting, it's not to contradict your point. I think what's interesting to me is that I did feel like actually in this group stage, some of those teams from the less well, the less rich countries actually have been some of the most compelling to watch. I mean, Slavia Prague, who finished bottom of a group with Barcelona, Dortmund and Inter with 2 points, still played really well in almost every game.
But see, I think this is what's really, really upsetting, that Salzburg, a slight exception, but, they're this fairy story funded by a multinational energy drinks corporation. This is Sleeping Beauty being woken up by Can of Relentless rather than the romantic kiss of the prince. This is what our fairy stories are these days. But I think there's four other smaller teams have played really well. Have been, as you say, very good to watch. So Dinamo Zagreb have been really good to watch. Club Brugge, Olympiakos, and Slavia Prague have all played above themselves. And between them, in the 24 games they've played, they've won two.
And the result as well is that because they draw the attention to themselves, then they will become the easy pickings. And like, for example, yesterday I was listening to some of the Club Brugge commentary. A lot of the commentary on Club Brugge was about their centre forward who was bound to join a bigger league.
Yeah, and with Salzburg, they're there to feed Leipzig.
Yeah. But do people care?
Not enough.
Yeah, they should care a lot more. And the other problem is, I don't know what the answer is. And maybe there is no answer.
Barney wrote in the paper today that, talking on sort of similar thing about this, that despite all those issues, which are huge, you can still appreciate beautiful football when it's played beautifully.
The football being played in the Champions League in the group stages now is the best football ever played, I believe.
So we should talk about it. That finish from Mo Salah is just... I tweeted out how brilliant it was, and lots of people going, "Oh yeah, he just scored an open goal." And you're just—I mean, I know you shouldn't look at that and go, "Oh please!" Like running at pace on your wrong foot, the ball—I mean, you can't curl the ball that way and it go in, Nicky.
Well, I certainly can't. it was a beautiful finish, and sort of in that way that happens sometimes in the game. He had much more presentable chances through the game up to that point, but finally took the one that was extremely hard to take. It was a wonderful finish. And I thought a really, in the end, a really impressive performance from Liverpool. They were not without their moments of vulnerability. I think it would have been extremely impressive and unlikely if they had gone to Salzburg, who attack as well as they do, and not had some moments of vulnerability. But you still never... I mean, there never came a point in the game where you worried that it was going to get away from Liverpool.
In the second half, I thought Liverpool controlled it pretty well. Yeah. The first half,
half was great, wasn't it? Yeah.
But then second half, you actually saw a different Liverpool. I think that's what was really impressive about it. It wasn't just the two goals. It was the fact that this is a team that's got, two clean sheets in the Premier League this season? Mm-hmm. And yet they held a very good opponent at arm's length and said, actually, big boys are playing now, just stay back.
Well, just about Mo Salah's goal, because I immediately thought, of Nwankwo Kanu's goal. Mm. But Kanu's goal, the ball is curling in.
Yeah.
Salah, I'm watching it. I don't understand, because it's going the wrong way. It's curling the wrong way, surely. And he doesn't have the space to make it curl.
Yeah, it makes the gap smaller.
Absolutely.
So the only goal that sort of it vaguely reminded me of was Mark Hughes' goal in the Cup Winners' Cup final in 91. But the angle wasn't as acute for Hughes, and the ball wasn't running at such a pace when he struck it, and Hughes was able just to smash it.
So we can comfortably say this is the greatest finish from an acute angle in the history of football.
That occurs immediately in my mind in the last 30 seconds or so, yes.
Okay.
Probably.
That was the second of five Liverpool games in 12 days, starting with their win at Bournemouth at the weekend, continuing at home to Watford on Saturday, then those two games in 2 days in two different continents. Those games will both be on British TV. Is that the first time in a long time when a team has played in two televised games in 2 days?
Should just have the last
Jurgen Klopp cam, shouldn't they? Like filming him just at the full-time whistle. He'll probably really go, "Can I leave 5 minutes early so I can get to the airport?"
We'll have a hologram.
He's not going to be out of the League Cup game, is he, surely?
Do you think he won't be at the League Cup game? I think he'll be at both. What do you think?
I just assumed he'd sort of be watching it on a dodgy stream like everybody else. Like.
No, I think he'll be there and then get a night flight.
God.
They can probably get a private jet, can't they? Liverpool, as opposed to just waiting for the
Qatar Airways will do anything.
here we go again.
Sure of that.
I don't know, don't want it to get missed. Quite a nice moment for Jurgen Klopp, I thought, this week, where he managed to apologise for being really rude to his for criticising his translator publicly, and come across like a good human being in the process.
Yeah. So in the first interview, the Jordan Henderson's asked a question and he says, look, we're not going to take this lightly. And the translator says, we're going to take this lightly, which is obviously quite a difference, isn't it? And it's also a footballer has the first time ever a footballer would go, actually, we're going to take this game quite lightly. And Klopp was quite short with him. I kind of understood why Klopp did stop him, but he was a bit of an arse. And then he did the next time say...
I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't say he was a bit of an arse. He was not very happy about it because he knew he was going to make all the headlines. Yeah. And he said, no, he was not happy about it, which I think rightly so.
No, you're right.
But in a way, didn't we have here a perfect illustration of Klopp's man-management, and extraordinary communication skills? Because on one hand, he really gave the guy some stick, which he deserved. Mm-hmm. And on the other, he was big enough to say, I gave you too much stick, my friend. Terribly sorry.
Yeah.
And you think, maybe he does the same things with his players.
Yeah. He's a modern-day hero, Jurgen Klopp, isn't he?
I mean, a bit, yes.
Great shame that Erling Haaland's scoring run came to an end, but scoring on your first five Champions League appearances isn't bad, is it? And he is some player. I mean, the more you watch him, the more you think, there was one chance where his first touch took the ball away from the defender. It was such a great bit of skill, and you think he's sort of got everything.
Yeah, but it was the second half, wasn't he? He had one miss at the near post where you thought, actually almost sort of really catches you off guard, which it shouldn't for a player that young to sometimes not do everything perfectly, but you thought, that was a presentable chance, he didn't take it. But it was right from the start, I thought that the tussle with Van Dijk was interesting. I mean, I think it was about 10 seconds in, they went straight for an angle ball, straight through the middle of the Liverpool defence, and Van Dijk just sort of had a little bit extra acceleration and got there first. But he gave him hard work all night. I think you saw him finding spaces all night. He's a really intelligent player for someone with such inexperience on this stage, at least.
And for someone who's sort of... Exactly, someone who's big and strong.
6'4", isn't he? Something like that.
They normally... don't learn how to play the game as well because they don't need to, but he...
No, and I think, of course, you need to say he does get... that team is built to support him. He does get some exceptional support. I thought Minamino's obviously a fantastic
Liverpool
player.
Liverpool apparently going to get him in January. That's the latest.
Oh, really?
Isn't this just confirming what Jonathan's been saying? As soon as we start talking these players up, it's who are they off to?
And is Haaland going to?
Of course he's going to go somewhere because that's how football works now. I'm really excited by him. I think he's... There's a saying in French for this, isn't there, Philippe, when you have something that you can't quite articulate that marks someone out as being different?
A little je ne sais quoi.
That's the one.
And now the other game in the group.
It's just not. It's not just the two of them. It's Hwang Hee-chan and Szoboszlai as well. Szoboszlai, I think, could be the best Hungarian since quite a long time ago.
Florian Albert.
Well, I was going to say Tibor Nyilashi, but...
I opened the file and Puskas was the one that came out in my mind. Well, the sooner they sell them to a big club, the better, eh? In the other game in the group, Napoli beat Genk 4-0 to finish second. Hours later, sacked Carlo Ancelotti. They weren't doing that well in Serie A. Is that a surprise, Nicky, or not?
Yeah, I think it's 10 games they've been without a win. It's not a surprise in some ways. Whether or not it's a good decision, it's a really complicated story, to be honest with you, because I think that you can't separate this decision from Aurelio De Laurentiis as an owner and how he views that club and what his expectations for it are. There's no question that results-wise, Napoli have been a disappointment in Serie A, and they've been a disappointment by Ancelotti's own standard. I mean, he didn't hide from it this off-season, this summer. He was saying, look, we're not messing around anymore. We're trying to win the title, and they're 17 points off first place already. They're well outside the Champions League places. It's going badly. But if you want to get into the expected goals and all that, they're underperforming relative to their actual performance. They, if you go on expected goals, they should be fourth, which is still not where they want to be, but it's a long way from where they are. And again, it's just hard to separate that from this whole story of De Laurentiis, who at the time was off doing his filming business in Los Angeles, decides that the team has disappointed him and says, right, you're all going into a punitive training camp. The players go for a few days and then basically rebel, mutiny against it and say, we're not staying here. Ancelotti is caught in the middle of all that and actually does go on his own to the training camp while the players go home. And it's just been since then that the atmosphere around the club has been really toxic. And when you think about, yes, the on-pitch performances have been good, but they haven't quite been scoring at the usual level. Well, that feels to me like something that reflects an atmosphere that is just not quite settled. That's a team that's still being set up to succeed, but isn't capable of getting its head right in, you know, in front of goal and those situations. I think that it feels fairly cynical from De Laurentiis to fire him now, because Ancelotti has delivered him the last 16 of the Champions League and the revenue they will get from it. And I think that with Ancelotti, you would have had a better chance of continuing to go far in this competition than you will now with Gattuso. But Gattuso is brought in to knock everyone's heads together and just get them back to fourth, hopefully.
So a,
and
they get a, next sort of a permanent again. Punitive training camp under Gattuso.
Well, I mean, the whole narrative of this, which is in all of the Italian papers this morning, is, oh, first training session, it was much more sort of shouting and hard work, which was supposedly a thing, which you hear, you know, you heard at Bayern Munich, this idea that Ancelotti does not make his players work hard enough, that he does not make them grind, that he does not tell them off enough. And so you go back to that and you go back to basics and you hope to get fourth and give up on the sort of potential, I think, to have done something really interesting in the Champions League. I mean, as bad as they have been domestically, they beat Liverpool, which no one else has done since May.
Mm-hmm.
They also drew with Liverpool at Anfield. In the biggest games, they've been still very, very good. It's something, you know, more insidious than that that has undermined them at a club level, and which is not all Ancelotti's fault. I mean, Dries Mertens, in the last 6 months of his contract, in the year that he's surpassed Diego Maradona as the club's all-time top scorer. Well, not all-time top scorer, because they're still a couple ahead of them, but surpassed him in the scoring charts. There's certainly a good degree of blame that you can hand to Ancelotti here. And I think it's certainly easy to understand from a business standpoint, and De Laurentiis, for all of his bravado, has been very good at Napoli at looking after the bottom line compared to most Italian clubs. So there's certainly a financial decision that you can make and say, hey, Gattuso cost us less than a fifth of what Ancelotti was costing us. Sure, you know, if he can come in and do an acceptable job, that's fine. But I think to in any way portray that Ancelotti is sort of solely to blame for what's gone on there is very misleading.
Ancelotti is the favourite now, pretty much, for the Everton and the Arsenal jobs, which will be tiring for him, won't it?
Well, if Klopp can do it, you know.
Would he be good for either of them? I mean, I can't see what he would bring to a relegation struggle, which arguably Everton are, well, looking at the league they're in, even if you don't think that they'd stay down there.
It's interesting because, again, we talk about reputations, and Ancelotti has been reputed as the guy who has won all these European Cups and has done it by taking over what were already very solid foundations at clubs and being able to take them that little extra step. So basically you give him elite players and he can take them one step further. His defence has always been, well, look, these are the jobs I've been given, and that's the job that's required in that situation. If you put me in a different situation, I will have a different strategy. So who knows? I don't think he's going to get, certainly, the Arsenal job. I don't know about Everton and whether they'd look his way. If nothing else, he's always been very fond of England, has enjoyed when he's lived here and talked about that very openly, so I'm sure he'd be open to it. But whether or not he'd be good for it, I think you can at least be open to what he says there, which is, well, we don't know, because he's not done that sort of job before.
And the other thing would be as well that if you're talking about two clubs whose main problems are in the league, if I'm not mistaken, I think Ancelotti called his autobiography Preferisco la Coppa.
Yeah, which is a play on meat as well.
Absolutely, yes, well. And which is, he's a cup man.
Yeah.
You know, his greatest successes have been in cup competitions.
I'm the cup guy. I like it.
He's
like
won
that.
Four league titles in 16 complete seasons with elite clubs.
One in four?
Well, yeah, but when you're the man who, as PSG manager, watched Montpellier win the league.
No, that's a good
point. As Real Madrid manager, you saw Atletico win the league.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's why you're here, Jonathan. You're useless, Ancelotti. Group H.
He's not useless. He's just useless for what Arsenal and Everton need.
Okay. Group H.
I mean, maybe Arsenal's best chance to get in the Champions League is to win the Europa League.
Hey, good point.
Right, Group H. Chelsea and Valencia through. Chelsea needed a win against Lille. They got it 2-1. Tammy Abraham getting his second Champions League goal. Nice little back heel. It's a great achievement for Frank Lampard, Jonathan, isn't it?
Yeah, brilliant. it's a difficult group with two other biggish teams in Ajax and Valencia. They were really good away at Ajax, I thought, that 1-0 win. They were very, very fortunate the last two games against Ajax and Valencia, that they should have lost both of those. And then
I think they were fortunate as well as good again away to Ajax. Yes, it was they played well and got that result, but they also had some good VAR, didn't they?
There was some good VAR.
But even against Lille, you know, they were comfortably the better side for sort of an hour or so, and then they end up clinging on. I mean, game management, it's not there, is it?
Lille finished the group stage on just 1 point. Them and Genk, the two teams,
which shows
the lowest.
What happens to a team that does too well. They've lost every single player.
Players of the quality of Nicolas Pepe.
He is a very fine player, as we will see.
So did you not expect them to do any better than that?
I had my doubts because they had lost so many players during the summer season. And despite the fact they've got a wonderful manager, Christophe Galtier, who's also lost his assistant, by the way, to José Mourinho. Yes, I was expecting them to struggle, which is very sad because they're actually quite a nice team to watch and very young and full of zest and all these sort of things, but we were not expecting them to go through.
Good header from Azpilicueta. Does anyone want to play the how old is Cesar Azpilicueta game?
34.
Cesar Azpilicueta, 31?
I'll go 29. I'll go in the middle, 32.
This is Richard Osman does a podcast called The Birthday Game, which is essentially that, but he's 30, yeah.
Is he 30?
I know, I had him at least 45.
Something funny going on there.
He's in good nick, isn't he?
Can we check his birth certificate or something like that?
We can't in the next hour.
Oh, for goodness sake. what has happened to modern journalism if you can't check basic details?
Nice for Loic Remy to score on his return to Stamford Bridge. First goal in the Champions League for 5 years. Chelsea apparently, now that they're allowed to buy some players, they've given Frank Lampard a £150 million war chest. Whoa. And he's going to get Nathan Ake and Wilfried Zaha.
I'd love to see a picture of that war chest one day. Maybe worth saying which clubs Chelsea are going to draw in the next in the round of 16, because we know this is pretty big. Mm-hmm. What they've got, it would be one of those five: PSG, Bayern, Juve, Barcelona, or RB Leipzig. That's pretty tough.
It is pretty tough, isn't it?
It's because they all come from the top five leagues in Europe, Philippe. There's no easy games at that level.
That's true.
So,
but hang on, Nathan Ake started out at Chelsea, right?
Yes.
Oh, yes, of course he did. Yeah.
So they're just signing back another player that they actually could have had.
Do they? It's
kind of a Chelsea thing, isn't it?
Do you think they actually think he's on loan? They're going to get another shot.
Are you sure he's not? I mean,
so many of them have been on loan over the past few seasons. It's quite normal if one name, you know, just passed through. I mean, what's happened? I thought they were more looking to in the left back, which you could understand.
Yeah.
A situation where they don't really have a settled left back. And
I was on the radio yesterday and a Chelsea fan rang in. He said, I don't think we really need to buy that many players. You know, we should just focus on the youth. It'd be all right if we just went and got Sancho and Koulibaly. And then that. Okay. Not really buying anyone. The group was topped by Valencia, who won 1-0 at Ajax.
Extraordinary story.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And for that semi final, you know, Ajax, they lost some players, but it still looked good, didn't they? But
they did the same thing as they did at Stamford Bridge. They completely lost it. You know, they finished with nine players, played very well with nine players at Stamford Bridge, but they lost their heads.
Yeah.
And they lost their heads even more, I would say, in the game against Valencia.
I still think that, yeah, they look back at the 2-1-0 home defeats and think, what were we doing? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Ajax probably should have gone through, but if you're losing twice at home 1-0, then.
And this might be actually the panic. And the fact of losing their heads, not just due to the fact that they're still a very young team, perhaps due as well to the fact that we should never have put ourselves in such a situation. This is so crazy.
Well, maybe some kind of hangover from the Tottenham game, even, that they suddenly just don't trust themselves with anything.
And injuries matter, right? They didn't have Quincy Promise, who's hugely important to them, and David Neres was out as well, wasn't he?
It did feel like a game, though, that even within that context, it felt like they should have won the game, but they just, as the guys have just been saying, like they sort of lost their nerve at a certain point. And in front of goal, everything felt very snatched. Everything felt very hurried in a way that it didn't need to.
But on the other hand, they might win the Europa League.
Well, the Europa League's got some
Europa League's become a really good competition.
Yeah.
Because I mean, there's probably a dozen, 15 teams who could win that. I mean, Salzburg could win that.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Gabriel Paulista's sending off was fun, wasn't it, at the end? He dived for a free kick. Tadic was really annoyed with him. And did one of those angrily pick you up And then he gently prodded Tadic in the face, who went down like he was shot. Just thoroughly tremendous shithousery from both players at all times. So
can you imagine having Gabriel Paulista's face about 1 millimetre from yours? I think you would fall to the ground pretty quickly.
On the Keown scale. On the Keown scale, where would you
Which
put...
Which kind of Keown? The Van Nistelrooy Keown
scale? Yes, of course. That's the only...
No.
That'll do for part one. Part two will begin with Manchester City. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. December the 20th, Jonathan, we're going to go to Leeds, aren't we? Me, you, Lars, and John Bruin.
Yeah.
For his live show debut.
That's a very hirsute lineup.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Apart from me.
Are you going to grow a beard just to fit in?
I mean, I literally can't.
Oh, tremendous. 20th of January, Nicky, me, you, Barry and Ellis playing the Salis Benny Theatre in Brighton. Is it a nice theatre?
I've actually never been, so it's going to be a good excuse to check it out.
Absolutely. We're over halfway sold on that, so get in quick. January the 27th in Dublin, sold out. 28th, few tickets remaining, so get them. And some new dates, March the 9th and March the 10th, we're going to Scotland. On the 9th, we're at Glasgow University Debating Chamber. Oh, we're going to have a debate. Excellent. And on the 10th, we're at the Pleasance in Edinburgh, where I'm going to do some of my observational comedy. That's what happens at the Pleasance, isn't it? Why do you look so shocked? Give it a go, eh? Why not?
I can think of so many reasons. But.
Group C, then. Man City trotted through quite comfortably, didn't they? A 4-1 win against Dinamo Zagreb. First up, though, Philippe, what a goal from Dani Olmo. That is just glorious, isn't it? I think the hardest, maybe the hardest skill in football, apart from, of course, touching it back to the thrower, which we all know.
Or apart from what Salah did.
Yes, okay. After that, so the third hardest skill in football after scoring from an acute angle and volleying it back to the thrower without just twatting it out of play is the volley with the ball coming over your head and striking the ball. It's a thing of beauty, Philippe.
Jamie Vardy style.
Absolutely.
Didn't make much of a difference, though.
It didn't make much of a difference. City equalised while one of the Zagreb players was dying in the penalty area. Then they should have had a man sent off. Ahmed Goyak elbows Rodri, I mean, right in the face. There is VAR, right? I was just watching it going, Someone must have looked at that and gone, well, not clear and obvious.
It was extraordinary because you had these two games going on, obviously, at the same time in the same group. And, you know, in the Atalanta game, Dodo gets sent off for
nothing.
Just nothing at all. And this on, you know, on the VAR evidence.
The nose.
Whereas this one doesn't get given and it doesn't make any sense to me at all.
No. I mean, if you were to say, you know, Siri, show me a clear and obvious elbow in the face, that's what it would show you, right? Yeah. Gabriel Jesus, that hat trick means he's scored all of his last 14 goals for City away from home, which is interesting. His second was beautifully taken. And Phil Foden with his third Champions League goal. What do we draw from this? I mean, the Champions League is really, really important for Pep, and it's really important for Manchester City.
Probably this season. I mean, apart from the cup.
The other cups.
But, I mean, the league looks out of sight. So, and you suspect the Champions League is what they've actually wanted to win for the last couple of seasons anyway. So,
and they're good enough, right? Or not?
Well, not at the moment, but when Laporte comes back... If Mendy is fit, then yeah, why not? I mean, I don't think there's a great side in Europe at the moment, apart from possibly Liverpool.
And I think this is every year it's the same thing. People try and decide who's going to win based on what's happened in December, when in reality it matters much more what your form is like in March, April, May.
I mean, Real Madrid are doing the classic Real Madrid thing of being crap for 3 months and then suddenly looking ominous as it gets towards Christmas.
Max says, not me, another Max, can we give Atalanta a couple of minutes today after their progression to the last 16? Best story of the season so far, Nicky.
Yeah, I'll give you as many minutes on Atalanta as you want.
How many can Nicky have? Two, says
Prince Jonathan. Two, someone set the timer. I mean, it's remarkable. Obviously, it's sort of outrageous that they've got through on 7 points. It requires a lot of things to go their way. It required a lot of things to go their way in this game. We've already talked about the Dodo sending off. Their first goal for Timothy Castagne looked for all the world to be offside, but VAR showed us that there was a rogue backhanging boot from a defender that kept him onside, and You know, that's how we analyse these things now. So they got some breaks in this game. They got some breaks in the group, because if Shakhtar and Dinamo don't draw twice, then the door isn't necessarily open for them to get through on 7 points. On the other hand, they are, you know, to remind ourselves, they are the team with the 14th biggest wage bill in Serie A. They've already earned more from this Champions League campaign than their wage bill for the year, just in prize money from this Champions League campaign. They're representing a town of 120,000 people. They've been playing their home games away from home at San Siro. And actually, I think that you could say they were due a slice of luck in this competition. They've had one really horrendous performance, which was the first one away to Dinamo, where I think they frankly just massively underestimated their opponents. Since then, they were very unlucky to lose at home to Shakhtar, I thought. They played a brave and naive game away to Man City. They drew with Man City at home, and then they've, you know, won two games. And I think they, and you have to, you know, in amongst all this, they've been missing for four out of those six games Duván Zapata, who was their top scorer last season. I would argue the only real striker in their squad. I know Luis Muriel plays as a centre forward, but for me, it's in that ambiguous zone where he's, I call him a forward, not a striker, because I don't think he does that, you know, has that thing in him, even though he's scored a fair few this season, of really seeing, as you know, Dries Mertens once put it to me, describing why he wasn't a striker, he doesn't wake up with the goals in his eyes like someone like Zapata does. And you know, they played this game without Josip Iličić. They've had plenty of adversity along the way. And to the point of rich leagues and rich teams doing things, I've already brought up the point of where they rank in terms of what they spend relative to other Italian teams. I don't even think they probably outspend Shakhtar on their wage bill, because from what I understand of what Taison earns, it's about $6 million. That would be nearly double what Atalanta's highest earner earns. And of course, you know, that may be a, you know, unrepresentative because it's one player, but they are a wonderful story. They're an immensely likable team. They've got, and Martin Deroon's one of the more fun social media followers of any footballer that I'm following. And Papu Gomez is just one of those players that I just watch him while he's there, because he's never going to get all these players we've talked about today, players who play for smaller clubs who have to go on to bigger clubs. He's never going to end up at one of those bigger clubs now, Papu Gomez, but he is just fun. He's, you know, he's incredibly talented and brilliant, and, you know, absolutely the heart of this team. But he's also just one of those players you watch him playing football and you think, God, this is not just your job. You are there because you bloody love playing football, and it comes through in how you play. And I think that embodies what this story is and why it's been fun to watch.
And I think that was, I'd say, 4.5 minutes. I'm going to move on, Philippe, to Group B. Bayern win the group, Spurs second. Bayern beat Spurs 3-1. It could have been 7-2, Philippe, couldn't it? But no one seemed to mind. It was quite a nice day out for everyone.
Yeah, I watched this game with, I was going to say one eye, but not even one eye. I was just, okay, oh, there's a goal. Oh, there's another goal. And it was completely, that was dead rubber. I mean,
If you keep letting Philippe Coutinho shoot, he will eventually score.
How many shots did he have?
1,000, I think.
In that one game. It's crazy.
Nice for Ryan Sessegnon to get his goal on his first start for
Kicked
Spurs.
It very hard.
He did kick it very hard. You're absolutely right. He absolutely melted it, didn't he? Did we learn anything else from Spurs?
No.
I didn't.
No.
I mean, they're not as good as Bayern at the moment. Yeah. They in two or
did
three
we
months
learn
tonight,
that, though?
Well, we had it reconfirmed.
Okay.
I suppose Bayern probably needed the win more than Tottenham did, actually, because of their form. But either way.
They're only the seventh team to win all six group games, which I guess is something.
And the form of Bayern is something which I found a bit bizarre, because you watch the games, actually, Bayern haven't been played badly at all. They've just been very, very unlucky in a few of those losses, recent losses. So
In the shootout for third place, Olympiacos beat Red Star Belgrade 1-0 to move above them.
What a crazy
Before we move on
penalty
from that
Bayern
game, can we talk about the sort of disco can-can that gets played after every goal?
Oh, for goodness sake, what on earth is that?
Has that been forever?
It's this season.
And how would you describe a disco can-can?
I don't know how else to describe it.
It's a Jaco van Beck.
Yeah,
it's like that tune, but they've added like a bit of an EDM.
Yeah, but it's Munich, for goodness sake.
Is that worse goal music than the sort of popular League One, League Two? I mean, that makes you want to be sick in your own mouth, that goal music.
Well, I mean, it's naff, but I don't really mind it. It's more the fact I find it so bizarre that they would play Offenbach, you know, that suddenly without the Folie Bergère and not at the Allianz Arena. That's just very strange.
Group F.
No, I hate all goal music.
Okay. Yeah, I'm with you, Wilson.
The handball that gave Olympiacos a penalty is perhaps the stupidest handball since Anders Limpar against Wimbledon in 1994.
Talk us through it.
What a reference point. That's spectacular.
I was doing a podcast about it 2 days ago, but that's why it's at the front of my mind.
What about the handballs of Anders Limpar? That is a niche.
There's a lot of podcasts out there.
You're right. You've got to find a new angle.
That's a great piece for The Athletic, though.
It really is. We met the man who made the ball.
And the hand.
Yeah.
God. Yeah. An exclusive interview. It's just a totally... Cross came in and sort of a very weird stuck his hand up and sort of flicked it away. And
Alan Hansen did that one day. I remember that. So one of these kind of volleying the ball with the hand.
Well, Limpar said that Limpar's was from a corner. You remember the game when Everton won 3-2 final of the season to stay up?
It was Graham Stewart.
Yeah, Graham
Hammett
Stewart
and Barry Horn
got his first two goals for Everton, and Barry Horn got the brilliant.
And Hans Sagers didn't have a great game.
Hans Sagers had a very good game until he let in the Graham Stewart shot with 9 minutes remaining and then got stiffed by the Grobbelaar trial, but was the first to be acquitted because there was absolutely no evidence.
Right.
And actually, if you watch that back, Stewart hits it very early. He's partially onside. I don't even think it's that bad a mistake. Anyway.
The handball.
Yeah, the Limpar sort of said that, you know, because everybody was so sort of twitchy about Wimbledon set plays, he just sort of, his brain just sort of melted, and even though he's under no pressure, he just
panic.
Sort of punched the ball away.
Right, Group F went right to the wire. Barcelona were already through as group winners. It was between Inter Milan and Borussia Dortmund for the second spot. Inter needed a win to qualify at home to Barca, so they couldn't manage it, losing 2-1, the same scoreline in the other game, but Dortmund with the winners against Slavia Prague. Another goal for Lukaku in that game. 12 for the season now for him. They had 8 shots Inter on target compared to Barca's 5. What went wrong?
I mean, actually, they didn't necessarily need to win. They just needed to equal Dortmund's result. And Dortmund, you know, playing against, as alluded to, that Prague team that was basically out of the running, didn't have it all their own way at all. That was a Prague I thought were really good from what I saw of that game. But, you know, this was, I don't know, I suppose the confirmation that Inter, while they are smashing small teams aside domestically, and that's allowed them to get up to first in Serie A, still haven't really done it in the biggest games. And this was one, you know, you should be able to win. It's a second string Barcelona.
Odd, haven't they, in the Champions League? I saw the game in Slavia Prague at San Siro when they were pretty bad and lucky to get away with a draw.
Yeah.
But then the game at the Camp Nou, they were really, really good. So the first hour of that game were the better side.
Yeah, I feel like they've played some of their best football in patches in the Champions League, and that was away to Barcelona and away to Dortmund in the first half, and both times they sort of faded. And the Barcelona game's interesting because, of course, they could have had a penalty in that game, and if they had, was it still 1-0 or was it 1-1 at the time? But either way, I think that could have been a very different ending. But this game, again, you could say some things didn't break their way. I think they had the ball in the net more than once, and it was disallowed for offside. They certainly created a fair amount. I think that attack of Lautaro and Lukaku is really interesting. I think Lautaro is on the way to being really, really special.
Mm-hmm.
And Lukaku's played well there. I think he's, you know, he's been he's not suddenly become a different player, but I think that Conte has the thing that he's got right so far is definitely he's got those two working an old-fashioned strike partnership, which you don't see that often, two real strikers like that playing together, and they're very effective together. The midfield has had a bunch of injuries. I mean, not having Barella and Sensi or Gagliardini is a lot, but this was a second-string Barcelona team, and they didn't control the game in the way that you should at home. They didn't dominate possession. They didn't really sort of exert that influence over the game, and they gave up more chances than they should, and they were punished for it.
Ansu Fati scored the winner. It's first since those two he scored in a row in September. A lovely finish off the post and in from 20 yards. Now the youngest ever scorer in the Champions League, beating Peter Ofori-K's record by 155 days. In Dortmund's game, Jadon Sancho opened the scoring in the 10th minute with his third Champions League goal, set up the winner for Julian Brandt. Fun moment on Dortmund's Twitter, where they posted pictures of some of the 7 saves Roman Bürki made in the game with the caption, "The Great Wall of Bürki," and then a minute later, "Goal, Slavia Prague, 1-1. Group A, PSG beat Galatasaray 5-0. Goals from Icardi, Pablo Sarabia, Neymar, Mbappe and Cavani. Cavani's first goal for PSG since August.
Yeah, and a real story, this one, because what happened is that he was given the ball to strike the penalty by Neymar.
Oh, was he? Oh,
so everybody loves it. Everybody again.
Do you know what, though? I mean,
just Neymar saying you're not a threat anymore.
Exactly.
Have a pity penalty.
Precisely.
Galatasaray weren't great, right? But PSG attacked in waves, didn't they? People saying this is a different PSG, Philippe. This is the one that won't crack in the quarterfinals.
Didn't they say that last year and the year before that and the year before that? To be seen in the league, they're awful, but they can win it at a canter being awful.
Well, they were 7 points clear at the minute.
They were 5 points clear, but they have one game in hand. I think. And in any case, they're very poor. In the league.
They're and they've really kept their performances. The home game against Real Madrid, though.
Excuse me?
They're very good at the home game.
No, I know, but in Europe.
Well, I'd say that's the best PSG performance. Maybe the 4-0 against Barcelona, which obviously
that's precisely
tainted by what happened.
Yeah, exactly. And there are still a lot of tensions within the dressing room. There are still loads of people who are not satisfied with Thomas Tuchel. There's still a lot of talk about Tuchel being on the ejector seat and who is going to take, Pochettino is now on the market and all this sort of thing. So it's not necessarily a very happy team. But I have to say, if you look at the squad they've got, if they're all fit, it is absolutely frightening.
It's brilliant, isn't
it? It's absolutely brilliant.
That midfield against Real Madrid with Marquinhos at the back, Idrissa Gueye to the right and Verratti to the left.
Yes.
That's just got much more bite and more balance.
It's the first time they've had a proper midfield for a very long time. Because remember, they used to play with Thiago Motta when he was about 46 years of age or something like that. And they never could find... And the problem Tuchel has, is that... You know, when you've got Mbappe, Cavani, Neymar, Icardi, Di Maria, you can't play all those guys at the same time together. Well, you could try.
Get Ardiles in.
It could be fun. but that is a problem. And Tuchel is trying to explain that to people, that he's got to think of the best possible team he can put on the pitch. And it's not necessarily
accepted by the biggest problem is Neymar's fit, right? If Neymar weren't there...
When Neymar is fit, he's absolutely fantastic.
But yeah,
he's not.
Galatasaray with this year's group stage lowest score is just one goal in six games, coming in a 1-1 draw with Club Brugge. Club Brugge lost 3-1 to Real Madrid, who were already through. Brugge qualified for the Europa League.
Their kit's really nice.
Bruges.
Yeah. In my head, it's occasionally wrong. Inter used to wear that shade of blue with their black back in sort of the early 90s. And I think it looks better than the darker blue they have now.
Bruges qualified for the Europa League knockout phase despite having just 3 points. Not the least ever, though. Borussia Dortmund came third in their group with just 2 points 2 years ago. The first Real goal was a lovely one. Modric with a beautiful pass with the outside of his right foot. He's good with the outside of his right, isn't he? Inch perfect down the flank for Odriozola.
That Modric goal, I think, meant it was a record number of goals on the group stage this season.
What, in total?
In total.
Oh, football's good again, isn't it? Group D.
So they give us goals to distract us from the economic truth.
Juve were guaranteed top spot. They won 2-0 at Bayer Leverkusen. Ronaldo and Higuain both scoring late in the game. Both goals assisted by Paulo Dybala, who is a lovely footballer, isn't he? Atletico qualified in second. They needed a win to be sure, and they beat Lokomotiv Moscow 2-0. Kieran Trippier missed a penalty. Well, it was brilliantly saved, actually. And then João Félix scored from the spot.
Do you think that award of a penalty was a bit weird?
Mm-hmm. Which one?
The second penalty.
Yes.
Because they obviously checked it for, was it a handball? It appeared to come off his chest to me.
I mean, I agree with you, and I have nothing, I have no comeback. The second goal was a lovely finish from Felipe. Juve, how important is the Champions League to them, and what are their chances?
I mean, of course, it's everything to Cristiano, isn't it? If it's everything to Cristiano, then it's important to Juventus, because that's why he's there. No, of course, the Champions League is a huge priority after winning 8 consecutive league titles. They've sailed through the group without mostly playing very well. I'd say that really the only player who I sort of feel like is playing really, really well at the moment is the one you've already named, which is Dybala, who's playing beautiful.
It's amazing that I mean, I know it was financial that they were looking to sell him, but the goals he scored in the Champions League have been superb.
Yeah, and he wasn't playing this well last season, and there was a sort of valid question of how you make Dybala and Ronaldo fit in the same attack without making your team incredibly flimsy. But he's so good on the ball. He's so good, and he's without question, the one opening things up for them at the moment. I know Ronaldo has finally sort of shaken off a little bit of that funk that he was in where he wasn't doing anything. He scored in the last few games, but he's very much being provided for by Dybala.
But Dybala's now got that weird thing where club level, how do you fit him and Ronaldo in? At national level, how do you fit him and Messi in? And now you've got Lautaro as well.
Lautaro as well.
And Icardi, though Icardi looks like he'll never get back in the Argentina team now, under the present management.
We're going backwards. I sort of wanted to ask Philippe how Icardi and Neymar are getting on.
On the pitch, okay. Off the pitch, I'm not too sure about that. What I can tell you is Mauro Icardi is doing very, very well on the pitch. He's having an absolutely superb season.
In Group G, it looked the closest to call on paper. There ended up being just 4 points between first and fourth. Leipzig and Lyon through. Leipzig went 2-0 up with two penalties before Lyon pegged them back. Nice curling finish from Houssem Aouar and the equaliser from Memphis Depay, 8 minutes from time. Zenit would have gone through if they'd matched Lyon's result, but they imploded after half-time. 2 minutes into the second half, they went 1-0 down. 9 minutes later, their left-back Douglas Santos got sent off for two yellows, both for handball, which is impressive. Benfica, it wasn't like he just was keeping the, keeping the ball up with his hand. Benfica scored a penalty, then they scored an own goal from a corner. Great finish. To be fair, they lost 3-0 and gave up their Europa League slot to their opponents.
We should highlight what happened at the Lyon game, which was quite something, really, because the qualification was totally almost unthinkable at one point. And then Memphis Depay has been made captain of the side, which is a decision which has surprised many people. And at the end of the game, some of the ultras of Lyon, Les Badgones, probably the most awful group of supporters in French football, to be honest, and I think this is a title that everybody will give them, took out this flag on which Marcelo was represented as a donkey, and Depay ran through across the pitch and took the banner away from the fan, and actually a scuffle could have erupted then, which many people have taken that as a, well, actually he does care, doesn't he? And maybe that was the right move, but that also shows you the atmosphere in that club is toxic at the moment. They still haven't accepted the fact that Rudy Garcia is the new manager. The fans seem to have developed almost a kind of fondness for hating their own team. It's absolutely awful what's going on. Whoever takes Lyon in the round of 16 has got a very good draw, I can tell you that.
Who do we think is going to win the Champions League? Give me just a team. I don't want any thinking. Wilson.
Liverpool.
Nicky.
PSG.
Philippe.
Manchester City.
In the Europa League, Arsenal will be through with a win or a draw at Standard Liège. They can go through with a loss too if Frankfurt lose their game. Manchester United are through, will finish top if they avoid defeat against AZ Alkmaar. Wolves are also through. They could get top spot if they win and Braga do not. Celtic are through as group winners. Rangers will be through as long as they avoid defeat to Young Boys.
Important for Scottish football if they, you know, because it could mean that they have two representatives in the Champions League very soon now because of the points they've accrued on the coefficient.
Yeah, and they've both done really, really well, haven't they, in their groups respectively. Speaking of Arsenal, finally a Freddie bounce of sorts on Monday night. They won 3-0 at West Ham. Arsenal, Philippe, were bad for 60 minutes and then good for nine. And it came out of it wasn't one of those games where you could accurately say Lundberg must have got right into them at half time because they didn't come out of the traps at
I think the only hope for them is that if the one thing that was needed more than anything was a win of any kind, of any sort. But the news before they go to Standard, which is, by the way, a pretty intimidating place to play in, are not very good in terms of the absentees and injuries. And with Pepe being injured, Bellerin being injured, Xhaka out, and I know people say, oh, Xhaka, actually, Xhaka's been quite decent recently since he came back into the team. So it's a very weakened Arsenal team that's doing that that trip to Belgium. Not too optimistic.
The finish from Pepe, though, was classic Arjen Robben, wasn't it?
That's who he is.
Yeah.
And people who've actually been to the games and seen him play will have realised he's the one who has actually brought danger almost every time he's been on the pitch, even if he's missed a couple of, you know, chances. Also scored, by the way, those two incredible free kicks, which put Arsenal in a decent mathematical position. Without him, they wouldn't be there.
Do you, Nicky, give Jumba credit for dropping Lacazette and playing Martinelli? Because that's sort of, on the face of it, looks like a brave managerial decision.
I don't know if credit's the right word. I'm glad that Martinelli got to start. I think he looks like he's genuinely something, and I think you have to give him a go at some point. So maybe it is credit. Definitely, I'm pleased that it happened and want to see more Martinelli because frankly, there hasn't been much else to get excited about recently, and he's worth getting excited about.
I'd forgotten Kieran Tierney, I think, amongst at least the majority. He's perhaps the most important for them because he's the best left back at the club.
Righty-ho, that'll do. For part two, part three, begin with the Football League. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Leeds, top of the Championship. They beat Hull 2-0 with two late goals on Tuesday. West Brom were held at Wigan. Their goal was fun, though. An indirect free kick on the six-yard box. Charlie Austin banged it in and then was immediately substituted. Preston up to sixth after beating third place Fulham 2-1. Big win at the bottom for Stoke in a six-pointer against Luton Town, and a good win for Huddersfield at Charlton. It was the final round of the Women's League Cup group stage fixtures this week. Arsenal beat London Bees 9-0, meaning they won their last two home games by an aggregate score of 21. Manchester United beat Birmingham 3-1 to qualify for the last eight, which in turn ensured Manchester City's qualification. So the last eight of the competition looks like this: Arsenal, City, Man United, Chelsea, Brighton and Reading from the WSL, and Aston Villa and Sheffield United from the Championship. Premier League games this weekend. Biggest game of the weekend, probably Arsenal v Man City, Philippe, on Sunday afternoon. Two defences that are leaky. What do you reckon? Six all? 7-1 City?
Yeah, something like that. I think it will depend a bit on the state of the players who are available and not available. If the spate of injuries that Arsenal have had doesn't show any sign of relenting, I think they could be in for a pretty unpleasant afternoon.
Well, the one thing you can say is that, you know, Arsenal are quick going forward.
Yes.
And City are very vulnerable to the counter. So that is a way that Arsenal could get at them. But.
And if you see the Arsenal, the same players, whom we saw, for example, in the second half against Spurs at the beginning of the season, you think, well, why not, actually? Because City in the league do look like a team that can be intimidated, actually, almost.
Two other interesting games on Sunday. Manchester United, Everton, both coming off the back of shock wins. Everton winning a game. Manchester United winning the Manchester Derby. Big Dunk will be in charge at Old Trafford, which I think everyone is just happy about seeing Duncan Ferguson there. But I wonder if you can't get that emotional again, can you? Can he do that every week, Big Dunk?
He won't do it with the ball boys, that's for sure, this time around.
With the Manchester United boys? It'd be nice to see, wouldn't it?
I mean, I'd like to see them try and turn him down for
a Wolves Spurs as well.
Well, I think this is a test for United in that they've been, last two games have been very good at counter-attacking. They're not going to be able to counter here because Everton will sit deep against them. So this is sort of a test of can this upturn be carried into games against mid-table and lower opponents?
Mm. Interesting test for Spurs at Wolves, actually, because Wolves are sort of under the radar.
Well, the only reason they're really under the radar is because of the start of their season, where they drew all these games and lost one, and then suddenly you look at the recent run of results, actually the manner in which they've acquired them, you think, my goodness, this is a seriously good Wolves side at the moment.
Liverpool's excellent record continues as they beat Watford in the early kickoff on Saturday. that could come back to bite me, couldn't it? No, it couldn't. Second place Leicester play second bottom Norwich. Chelsea host Bournemouth, who've lost five in a row in the league, so you can't imagine much changing at the top. Southampton West Ham, the late game on Saturday, is a huge football match. It was so big, Philippe did this hand gesture where he sort of he shakes it back and forward, but not in a rude way.
Not at all.
He's not gesturing at me.
I didn't have a Honigstein moment.
No, you didn't. Monday night sees the A23 derby between Palace and Brighton. David says, I can't work out if I feel proud or frustrated at Newcastle United for the free half-season ticket giveaway. For years, I've anecdotally argued clubs don't need ticket revenue so much these days. Is it a cynical move to mask discontent? Probably. So Newcastle offering season ticket holders a free additional half-season ticket to gift a fellow supporter to help fill the ground. Sunday's win over Southampton was their lowest attendance.
I actually think that's a really fascinating concept, because it calls back to what we talked about earlier in the podcast, where I was saying NFL teams are struggling to fill their stadiums, and they've done things like that. They've given tickets away, and they've said to season ticket holders, here's a free ticket for these games to bring people along. And I don't see that. I personally don't have a problem with it. I think it's easy to mock that and go, oh, you can't fill your own stadium, whatever. But if the point is to get people in the stadium, to bring an atmosphere, to have a crowd who want to be there, and the revenue is, I mean, if it's not coming anyway, it's not coming anyway. I mean, obviously, maybe a little bit more work for clean up afterwards, but it doesn't massively alter your costs for running the stadium.
Well, in fact, you might make some money from selling hot dogs and whatever.
I mean, this is you can go cross industry on this as well. It's a problem that cinemas face now. And should you be charging a lot for a ticket, or should you just be trying to get people in the door and then they'll buy some popcorn and some drinks while they're there? Because you're competing in different ways now. You're competing with Netflix, so it's all business. But I don't have a problem with
that. My immediate question with it is, how does it actually work? Because if you got your season ticket and you're surrounded by other season ticket holders, where's the seat that your mate's going to sit in? Do you get to sit next to them?
That's a fair point.
Mm. Tickets, will it be available on a first-come, first-served basis from Tuesday? From the Times today, the FA and other British football associations will be part of a bid by UEFA to change the rules relating to marginal offside decisions, having seen many players affected by the offside armpit this season. According to the Times, the use of VAR to overrule such armpit offsides has caused unease in UEFA. How are you? Uneasy. Why? Offside armpit. The various parties agreed to work on changing the use of VAR so offsides are judged on clear and obvious error rather than the marginal decisions as they are now. I mean, the worm's already out of the can, but they're going to spread even further, aren't they? Because then someone's not going to be...
Well, they'll do it wrong. So what they'll do, or what I fear they'll do, is they'll say, if you're 10 centimetres offside, you're actually onside, which is crazy, because you're still having a line that where, you know, suddenly, you know, people will legitimately get upset. Hang on, he's 10.1 centimetres offside. Why is that different from being 10 centimetres? Yeah. So what they should do is, we know what the margin of error is within each frame. You can work out the pace of the players. You know what the margin of error is. And so you know the probability of the player being offside. And if I probably clicks over 50%, you call it offside.
I like that there's a greater margin of error for Raheem Sterling than there is for Grant Holt.
But there is, though.
Yeah.
Because the distance he moves between frames, the distance that Raheem Sterling moves between frames could be as much as sort of 15 centimetres. Grant Holt, I don't think he would move 1.5 centimetres between frames.
The thing is that thinking of
Grant
Timothy
Holt against
Castagne,
Iglesias would be kind of quite a good...
The Timothy Castagne goal... I still cannot fathom that, because the part which is offside is the cleat, the back cleat of his heel when he's running.
No, the part that plays him onside.
Back him onside.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's facing the wrong direction, and his legs are moving. You think, hold on a minute, this is the point of reference.
Yeah. Mm.
This is crazy, and it's well within the margin of error of even ultra slow HD, whatever, it's well within the margin of error.
I mean, the other thing that should be done, and I suspect that they won't do this for some kind of human rights concern or something silly like that, is that anybody who signs up to a professional footballers' union gets a chip implanted in the exact centre of gravity of their body. Because that's one of the problems, right? If the Atalanta Shakhtar offside, it looked wrong because you can see the main mass of their body.
Exactly.
And it was a sort of protruding foot and then a stud on the end of the boot. So if they had that chip, it'd be much easier to measure.
Does the exact...
And yeah, they get paid enough, for Christ's sake.
Does your exact centre of gravity change? So like Memphis
Depay...
Well,
you check it every season. Yeah.
Memphis Depay's kind of filled out a bit. He's got a bit hench. Does that move where you're... Or is it always in the same place?
I love that the podcast started with Jonathan reeling against the problems of modern football. It's going to end on future football that involves chips.
Time now for Philippe Auclair's redacted section.
Oh, no. I mean, you won't have anything to redact. It's just an interesting little story which has popped up this week FIFA has realized that, according to Swiss law, if they wanted to get back the 2 million Swiss francs that Sepp Blatter very kindly gave to his friend Michel Platini, well, his friend at the time, they had to do something before the end of the month. Otherwise, it would be too late. That's the reason why they are now saying, oh, we're going to sue for recovering this money, which was paid in 2011, and which relates to an oral agreement that nobody knew about, and which was paid 9 years later. And which is the reason why Sepp Blatter and Michel Platini were suspended by FIFA's own ethics committee. So they decided, no, we've got to do something. We haven't got that money back. And the other thing which is very funny is that Michel Platini still hasn't paid the fine that he was given when he was banned by FIFA. He still hasn't paid it, the 60,000 Swiss francs. So they're a bit annoyed with that.
60,000 Swiss francs is what, about 30 grand, is it?
It's a bit more than that. I think it's 60,000 Swiss francs, about 50 grand or something.
As much
like
as that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Plus, he hasn't paid his legal costs either yet. So that's Platini.
I'll give him a break. He's a good player.
But he's also facing... Blank.
That was the redacted bit, guys.
He's also facing more stringent scrutiny in France as well.
Yes, right? Because something very important has happened, is that the Parquet National Financier, which is the Serious Fraud Office, has finally opened on 9th of December an official investigation into Qatar 2022. There was an investigation. This is different. It's been given to a juge d'instruction. We don't have an equivalent here in the UK, but the juge d'instruction is somebody who's got powers which far exceed that of normal justice, as in, for example, should he decide let's search this guy's flat. You don't need to tell him about that. Just arrive. Here's the paper. Move out of the way. We're taking everything. So the next few months could be quite fun.
Jonathan says, which Premier League manager would make the best prime minister?
Well, Jürgen Klopp, obviously.
Yeah, it's Klopp, isn't it?
All right.
I mean, he's charismatic and he thinks the right things.
Not
and he gets things done.
An update from Barry. He said this morning, I paid my interim Goa bar tab today, 5 days, £91, including several meals.
What is it, like 9 pence a pint?
Well, he then followed it up by saying, that's to do with how cheap things are, not to do with how abstemious I've been. I'd said, I think most people would understand that. He spent yesterday evening drinking with an actor who played a minor role in several episodes of The League of Gentlemen. Finally, Jonathan, the things you were... not banned from doing as a child, but positively discouraged.
I mean, anything on ITV to start with.
Right.
I mean, I guess probably not detective shows on a Sunday night, but certainly... Yeah.
So you were allowed Poirot, but you weren't allowed Grot Bags and The Witch.
Exactly.
Right.
Star Wars I didn't watch till I went to university.
Wow.
Transformers, never had any of that.
No.
No chocolate, it sounded like.
Was there Coke in the fridge?
No,
there wasn't in my house.
No, if it got very hot in the summer, we'd get some sort of fizzy drinks, but you'd be limited to one a day.
Oh. Own brand cola?
Yeah.
Wow.
Did you have other toys? Because the starting point in this conversation, I actually think, was weirdly about Kinder Eggs, and you know, you were quick to point out that they wouldn't have been allowed in your house because they were decadent.
But they were frivolous,
and Transformers likewise. So is it toys in general? Is it the sort of?
He's right, isn't he? A Kinder Egg is frivolous.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
I mean, it had Spooky, obviously.
Okay.
Okay.
Did I have anything else? I mean, I had a Commodore 64 and played football games on it.
They were the best times, weren't they? Emlyn Hughes International Soccer.
Oh, what a game that was.
That was a good
one. A cartridge as well, not even a tape.
Oh, no, I was loaded very quickly. I actually had a built-in disc drive on my Amstrad.
Jesus Christ, you are.
But that is it. Still a man of the people, everybody. That'll do for today. Thank you, Nikki.
Thanks.
Thanks, Philly.
Thank you.
Thanks, Wilson.
Cheers.
Back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.